might we change the debate around the way we do capitalism? It's something we cover, as you know, and quite a lot of you text or email me about this. Well, we're now to meet a prominent visiting economic thinker who believes language matters more than you might imagine because it releases spirits that otherwise lie dormant in organisations like governments, with the resulting loss, as we've just heard, of possibility and citizen trust, that vital commodity. My guest wants governments especially to access the bold within them rather than the cautious, to break down the myth that's taken hold, as she sees it, that they're merely big lumbering bureaucracies, blocking the way of more agile entrepreneurs. She wants us to value the way we talk about wealth creation and restore the rightful place of value in economics. Mariana Mazzucato is London-based, will be visiting Australia next week to spread her message about shifting the agenda. She's an economist and a professor in the economics of innovation and public value at University College London, the founder and director of the Institute for Innovation and Public Purpose there, and she advises governments and institutions around the world. She'll be arriving in Australia on Sunday for a series of events in Sydney and Melbourne, including presenting the 2018 John Menadue Oration for the Centre for Policy Development. Mariana, welcome to Saturday Extra.
Hello, I'm very happy to talk to you.
Could we start with this question of values? You're not talking about really behaviour, are you? But what something is worth, what it deserves, something you say was at the heart of economics, but has been lost in our modern day capitalism. What do you mean by this?
So I've just been very taken by how easy the word value creator, or especially wealth creator, is used almost just in common parlance. So, you know, when the Labour Party in the UK lost the election in 2015, that was Ed Miliband with David Cameron, they actually said, we lost because we didn't embrace the wealth creators. And by that, they meant business. And I thought, how could a Labour Party actually have such a skewed notion of where wealth comes from? And basically, on both sides of the political spectrum, I think we've been conned into thinking that value is created in business, and the best that the public sector can do is facilitate that process. And the words, literally the storytelling around that, is that public policy is about fixing problems. So you fix a market failure, you de-risk, enable, facilitate. But all the dynamic, interesting stuff is in business. And then if you actually look at history basically of capitalism, which came after 500 years of feudalism, which was kind of a state of no change, inertia, most of the really big changes, even just technological changes, actually occurred when the state, alongside business, was able to organize itself in strategic, ambitious, what I call mission-oriented ways, and really kind of lay the groundwork for big changes to come, you know, from the moonshot program, getting to the moon and back again in a generation, where all the spillovers from that basically ended up in our smartphones, you know, internet, GPS, touchscreen, all basically came as spillovers of military investments, but then also in the health sector, something like two-thirds of the most revolutionary drugs, we call these new molecular entities with priority rating, trace the research back to public funding, but we don't have a way to think about it. And so what that also does is we end up not having a debate in society about what it is we're actually kind of creating. So part of the problem is that some states don't organize themselves to play this investor first resort kind of entrepreneurial role, and you just have a lame duck market fixing role. Or even when they do play that role, it isn't kind of recognized explicitly. So there isn't a kind of democratic debate about what should be invested in. But also often the state doesn't get back its proper return for that investment.
So for you, value is different to price, is it? The theory of price, really. I mean, I'm thinking about how the classical economists thought about this.
Yeah, sorry. So I guess I was going more into sort of the modern manifestation of the lack of this debate. So what I tried to do in the book, The Value of Everything, was actually to trace back this problem to the fact that over the last, I would say, 50 years, we've lost the core debate and the way to have that debate that actually characterized economic thinking for almost 300 to 400 years, which is that there was a real discussion about where does value come from. And that discussion in both the physiocrats who were writing in the 1700s when we still had an agricultural economy, and the classical economists later who were writing during the Industrial Revolution. So this is Adam Smith, David Ricardo, and Karl Marx. Both types of economists were really focused on the conditions of production, whether it was land or industrial labor. They looked at production, the division of labor, technological change. and changes in those features, and basically had a theory of value which determined then how they understood theory of exchange and prices. Whereas what we have today with neoclassical economics, the real underlying issue is that we have a problematic theory of value which is divorced from how we understand value to be objectively created in terms of how we produce things, the division of labor, the different actors that are responsible for that, then we basically end up confusing prices with values. And for me, value is fundamentally collectively created. Again, if you look at the energy areas.
Is that not a value judgment? I suppose clearly I'm sure listeners will think, well, yes, but this is open to all manner of subjectivity.
Interpretation.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, interestingly, I basically argue actually that we've allowed value to be completely subjective. So, you know, the way we price drugs, so medicines, is based on this formula called value-based pricing, which is literally allow prices to go to what the market can bear. So value is in the eye of the beholder. But my real point is we no longer debate it. It's not contested. So it becomes really easy for value extraction to pass for value creation. Why? Because this word value is just this really confused, fluffy, kind of flaky term. And so for me, at least my ambition is to bring back the contested nature, the debated nature of value. So before someone like Lloyd Blankfein, the CEO of Goldman Sachs, being able to simply say Goldman Sachs workers are the most productive in the world, which, believe it or not, he said in 2009, just 1 year after the crisis, he would have to sort of think twice, oh dear, are people going to think I'm completely mad by saying this? Because the way we would talk about productivity, productiveness, and value creation would be a bit more informed in society. So he would be, if you want, contested.
That does help people to understand. And on this, you wanted to shift the debate. And on this other major area about the importance of the state in leading innovation and not just being a facilitator of the innovators. Now, that's another area you felt had really slipped badly.
Well, they're actually related, because if we understand value as being fundamentally an outcome of the ways that different actors in the economy, including, you know, civil society organizations, so trade unions, have been fundamental in shaping markets. You know, we have weekends and 8-hour workdays because trade unions fought for that. That helped shape the type of markets we have. If we understand markets and values being outcomes of these collective activities, which are often full of conflict, this isn't like a ballet, then we have to understand that one of these actors, which is basically the state through its different types of public institutions, should also be understood in terms of its potential of creating value. It might not create value, just like the business sector might not create value if it's governed improperly, or if it's not very efficient or inertial, or obsessed with its share price as opposed to actually producing stuff. But similarly with the public sector, if we don't have a framework through which to understand it as a value creator, we might actually structure it really problematically. So it's not about saying the DNA of the state is great or it's terrible. It's that unless we have a framework through which we understand also the state as a value creation engine, if you want, then we end up not structuring it as such. And so part of the ambition there was literally just to look at history, the history of the IT revolution, nanotech, biotech, pharmaceuticals, and today the clean tech sector have absolutely benefited from having, in some countries, a very active investor first resort role of a particular public entity.
So I think what you're saying is that even if money has to be plunged into aspects of state production, if it's value creating, that's fine. Whereas, of course, the great complaints made is that government is a money trap, and that in effect it becomes sluggish money. That was, well, for the last sort of 30 years, I suppose, since the Reagan-Thatcher times, that's been the slur against government, hasn't it?
Well, but the problem is, does it become a self-fulfilling prophecy when both Reagan, said, if government asks, how can I help, you have to worry, because that's the first moment to worry, because government shouldn't get in the picture.
That was the great, David Cameron, hilarious BBC, we're here from the government, we're here to help. I mean, that became a joke.
Exactly. But also David Cameron more recently said, that the state is the enemy of enterprise. And many people think that basically the state is just there to regulate, to administer, but then get the hell out of the way to let the revolutionaries and business do their thing. When again, just historically, just literally just looking at sector by sector by sector, you actually see that business only really entered and was willing to invest after a particular state entity laid the groundwork.
I'm going to interrupt because you have a wonderful line. The traditional way of framing the debate about wealth creation is to picture the private sector as a magnificent lion caged by the public sector. Remove the bars and the lion roams and roars. In fact, you argue, private sector companies are rarely lions, far more often they're kittens. Now, what do you mean?
Well, the reason I actually put in the book, The Entrepreneurial State, a lion and a little pussycat on the cover was precisely due to that point. And it was really actually taking from a nice letter that John Maynard Keynes, the famous economist, wrote to Roosevelt. I think it was in 1932. He said, we got a problem here. We're kind of assuming that business really wants to invest, but actually most of businesses are just domesticated animals. They're not wolves, tigers, or pussycats. And had modern day Keynesians really understood that, then I think actually the progressive parties of the world would have had a different agenda. It would have been, oh, wow, there's a pussycat. Let's get that pussycat to want to roar. Mm. Let's invest in really cool new areas, which would include, by the way, cultural areas, which really kind of increase the expectations of business of where the future opportunities are. And that way, you would also have more business investment because so many countries actually don't grow through business investment. They grow through personal private consumption. So in both the US and the UK, which is really where the global financial crisis in some ways began, we currently have now record levels of private debt. So that the ratio of private debt to disposable income is actually back to what it was just before the crisis. And guess what? That caused the crisis. So
yes,
that's the bad news for your listeners. We're about to have another big bust potentially. But, you know, if we want to change that, you need to ask, well, what can we do as a society to increase the expectations about these opportunities, but maybe also direct them towards these big societal challenges that we have, whether they be around climate change, rethinking healthcare systems, sustainable cities, future of mobility. That really is what the state should be doing, investing in high-risk, ambitious, bold, inspirational areas that pave the way for new investment opportunities for business.
And it's the green economy where you say some governments are really leading the way. What are they doing and where?
Right. Well, you know, some people think this is just about creating, fixing the problem of, say, negative externalities, pollution, so a carbon tax. But the countries that are leading on green innovation, I think, have been able to think much more systemically. And that's about really greening the entire economy. So I found quite interesting how in Germany, their Energiewende policy wasn't just about renewable energy. It really was about reducing the material content of the entire manufacturing base. So the steel sector in Germany, unlike in many other European countries, has in fact lowered its material content, but it wouldn't have done it without the government kind of setting the stage with this vision of Energiewende. But what's really interesting in Germany is that itself would not have happened without decades of a green movement. So this really opens the door to say, hold on a second, perhaps what we need is ambitious leaders in politics who also are good listeners in society. So instead of just letting populism kind of go its way, listen to what people are asking for or fighting for, which in some ways happened in Germany. They listened to the green movement. They brought this sustainability and green issue to the core of politics, created a vision and a mission around Energiewende, and then rewarded, this is really key, rewarded those organizations, small, medium, or large. They didn't obsess about SMEs, small, medium enterprises, any organization, whether it was small or large, that was willing to invest in these difficult areas. So, you know, lowering the material content of steel required a transformation of steel. So instead of using government programs to give handouts to particular firms or sectors or even academics, I mean, we academics get handouts all the time, you know, the point is to use these instruments, whether it be through procurement policy, prize schemes, grants, loans, or subsidies, not just for the sake of it to help a particular sector or a particular actor in the economy, but to achieve a societal goal.
Right.
And that's what got us to the moon. And I believe that we have these sustainable development goals. There's 17 of them. Over 100 countries have signed up to them. The real issue now is how to turn them into missions that have a concrete roadmap that requires lots of different sectors to invest, and also cities, regions, countries to actually create, you know, a vision. As Germany did, Denmark, by the way, sorry, I keep interrupting you. I'm a terrible guest. Denmark is currently the number one provider of high-tech green services to China's green economy. China, massive country, Denmark, tiny. China spending $1.7 trillion, that's 12 zeros, on greening its economy, including energy-friendly technologies and, of course, renewable energy. Mm. And a little country like Denmark, because it had a vision and an ambition around sustainable cities, but also it had a strong manufacturing base that has to be serviced, was able to capture that transition in China, which is due to the pollution problem, as an opportunity for investment and innovation.
But that means government's trying to pick winners, doesn't it? And that's a real accusation thrown and a warning, certainly given in Australia.
So I usually kind of turn that on its head. I say, exactly, don't pick winners, pick the willing. Who's willing? You know, it's not about choosing one sector, one technology, or one firm. It's about setting a direction. And then again, using the full power of government instruments to reward those businesses that are willing to transform themselves to meet that objective. That's very different from having a policy which says, oh, let's give a bunch of handouts to the steel sector or to the high-tech startups or to a particular company just because it's small. That's the picking winners problem. And that is a problem because you're putting a characteristic of a company, you're making that the sort of criteria versus what is the public objective.
Well, Mariana Mazzucato, it's certainly exciting hearing you sketch all that. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. I hope you enjoy your trip to Australia.
Thank you very much.
Mariana Mazzucato, who's Professor in the Economics of Innovation and Public Value at University College London and founder and director of the University's Institute for Innovation and Public Purpose. Her latest book is The Value of Everything, Making and Taking the Global Economy.